After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to Ram Dass Here and Now. I'm Raghu Marcus with a new edition of this podcast that is so much fun for me. I really love looking for all of these different talks of Ram Dass's or parts of talks that, they basically interest me. And so it gives me a chance to share, which I love to do. And this particular talk is actually Ram Dass with several friends, and it's more contemporary. Usually what I choose comes from deep in the archives of our media library from ramdass.org, Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. And this one in particular is pointedly part of a new web destination that I wanted to mention to you, to everybody out there listening. It's a podcast network called mindpod.network.com, MindPod. And interestingly enough, as I listened to this talk, Ram Dass came up with a whole thing around something called Soul Pods. And I thought, wow, Soul Pods, that's a good name too. But we have Mind Pod. And his Soul Pods thing was about, he said, in Dharma Land, we are connected. So there's groups of people that are very connected. And he was referring in particular to this group that met in Bodh Gaya in 1971, who did these meditation courses, Vipassana courses. And many of these people emerged as teachers in the West, from Jack Kornfield to Sharon Salzberg to Joseph Goldstein to Danny Goleman, of course, Ram Dass and Krishna Dass, and on and on. So Ram Dass referred to that as a soul pod. And in Dharma Land, he said, we're connected and we come to help bring awareness to each other and everyone we meet. So it's a beautiful little... and nobody take that out there, okay? That's Ram Dass's Soul Pod. We got to get it copywritten. So this this hangout is basically Ram Dass did a podcast with Wes Nisker and Catherine Ingram and Jack Kornfield, who were visiting him in Maui. And I just love this whole thing. It's I say this over and over every time I look and find a talk, and I'm, thinking I'm too busy to listen to the whole thing. And then I end up being sucked in myself. And that happened again with this. So it's got a lot of riches. It's got Jack telling his story of meeting RD and their history together. And in fact, the three of them talk about how they first met Ram Dass and sort of the gathering of the tribe, back to that soul pod thing, and how these Westerners basically took from the East in their minds and hearts essence of Buddhism and Hinduism, which represented deepening our understanding of ourselves. I think that's succinctly put about how this the genesis of these people at that time, and how what this meant to them, and how they took this and brought it to the West. Pretty nice history, kind of a history lesson around this, and it's something that I think many people have asked about, how all these people met up and so on and so forth. This also has the origins of Ram Dass's, at this time, I think it was a couple of years ago, Ram Dass's thing around loving, teaching around loving awareness, which is, he's just introducing to these guys. And so that's, pretty interesting as well to hear that. There's all sorts of different topics in here that they managed to get to. None the least, of course, is this around Buddhism and Hinduism, and how these guys are all Buddhist teachers, and really talking about how they've come around at this point in their lives to realizing just how important love is in the practice, and how they do blend that, and how Jack talks about how much loving kindness and metta is expressed in the teachings at this point, and how that really comes together with Ram Dass and our relationship with Maharaji and Bhakti Yoga. And another thing, I really love this particular thing that Jack talks about. It's something that I have talked about on Mind Rolling, which I think some of you know that I do with David Silver, and that's called the spiritual bypass. And Jack talked about it because, I don't know, I think Ram Dass was sort of kidding him a little bit about his, firm focus on dealing with psychological stuff and that he did, in his earlier days. And he talked about, and this, I think this is just a common occurrence with people, with all of us, who get involved with the spiritual path and teachings to, as we said earlier, to get to know our true selves. And, in the process, we get high. I mean, it's a lot like acid in a microcosm. But how we get high, but how we use that high not to deal with our stuff. I think that's a critical topic that I'm glad they brought up here, and it's something that at some point I'd like to further in some of these podcasts and maybe talk to Ram Dass a little bit more about it. And there's a lot of talk, there's quite a segment devoted to suffering, which, what is it, how do we relate with it in our lives? And Ram Dass talks about himself with the stroke, that pain was the adversary to his sadhana, and he'd get caught in pain, and then as soon as he was able to get into that loving awareness place in his heart, he was able to witness it, and then it backed off and became more distant. And nobody has more experience with directly with pain for the longest time than Ram Dass. And then he mentioned suffering allows you to understand your attachments, and particularly life versus death. I mean, so there's deep, talk about deep thoughts. So very rich stuff here. Again, I want to go back to our MindPod Network. Go to mindpodnetwork.com and look at, in one website is a destination of this soul pod. And we should, I love that term. So you have Ram Dass's podcast there. You have Mind Rolling, me and David Silver, and you have Jack Kornfield, and you have Sharon Salzberg, and you have Krishna Dass, rich stuff. Not just the podcast. There's plenty of blogs. You get Krishna Dass doing his kirtan thing, recommendations for books, and so on. And of course, the way that all of this podcast gets supported. It's through simply, it's all free, but it's through your support and donations that we count on. And particularly to go into any one of these podcasts or MindPod Network as a blanket for all of this, and bookmark the Amazon links, either the one link for MindPod or say I just want to support Jack. Well, you can do that and just grab his link. which is you just easily navigate to his page and grab the link and bookmark it, and then everything that you buy, both Jack and MindPod will get a piece of. A very small percentage, but if you invite your friends and neighbors and family to do this, because it absolutely takes nothing away, even if they don't care about any of this Dharma stuff. You know, get Aunt Mabel, who sits there and orders Amazon stuff day in and day out, get over there and just, you know, do us a big favor and just bookmark it yourself. Like, take the link and just put it right up on her bookmark bar. So here is this exceptional hangout, basically, with Ram Dass, Wes Nisker, Catherine Ingram, and Jack Kornfield on Maui. And this is Ram Dass here and now.
What is your name, sir?
Oh, my name. Well, I just assumed everybody would know me. My name is Wes Nisker, and I'm not a Hindu. I am a Jewish person. I'm a Buddhist Jew, and I've been involved. I first met Ram Dass, so very quickly, I met Ram Dass 40 years ago in Bodh Gaya, India. We both were at a meditation retreat. There were only about 30, 35 people there. Among them was Ram Dass, myself, Krishna Dass, Daniel Goldman, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg. And here we are 40 years later, having smuggled this Asian wisdom back to the USA.
Yes.
And how do you think it's going?
Well, this is certainly a measure of how it's going.
We're in trouble.
And my name is Catherine Ingram, and I first read Be Here Now, I think in 72, maybe when it first came out. Was it 72? And in 1974, I went to Naropa to meet that guy over there, because I was used Be Here Now as my Bible. And in fact, Ram Dass had a reading list at the back of the book, as probably most of you know. And I read through every one of those titles. I read every book that he recommended. And I was quite a young person then. And all fired up and went to Naropa to be with Ram Dass. And there got introduced to an entire world that, ruined the rest of my plans for life. But I've been having a pretty good time since those days.
Didn't you get any Buddhist teachings there?
I did. I met Joseph Goldstein there, and then I began going to retreats. I went to a retreat with Joseph right away in 1974, and then with Jack immediately. Jack and Joseph were teaching together, and I became involved with helping start the center in Barrie that Jack was also involved with, and just been on the Dharma trail all these years. And actually, Ram Dass invited me to teach at some of his retreats back in the early 90s, and that launched into a sharing that I've been doing ever since. So,
yay.
I sometimes tell people the Dharma ruins your life, you know, the life that you had planned, the things that you were trying to get away with, in a sense, or all the different ways you were trying to find happiness in this and that. You know, you fall in love with the Dharma, and it's all of that has to just...
We are all falling in love with the Dharma.
Yes, we are. Yeah. That is true.
So I came back from being in the forest monasteries of Thailand and Burma in 1972, also read Be Here Now, and then found my way to... I started graduate school in psychology because I wanted to figure out what happened to me, basically, and see if it would help. I'll get there.
Okay.
I'll get there. And I went to the first meeting of the Massachusetts Psychological Association, and there was Dan Goleman, who showed a big mandala of the Tibetan wheel of birth and death and was giving this whole Buddhist psychological teachings to the psychologist there. And I introduced myself and he said, come over to David McClellan's. David had been the chairman of the Department of Social Relations at Harvard, who both hired and fired Ram Dass.
Yes.
And all things in between. So I went over, and that's where my name is Jack Kornfield, and that's where I met Ram Dass and Danny Goleman and Chogyam Trungpa. One of those days he was drinking and we had a nice conversation about monasteries, and he said, hold on just a moment, it's probably my daughter calling, I'll call her later. Stop that. Hi, Mom, I'm talking to Ram Dass, it's okay. Chogyam Trungpa was drinking and he said, I want to start a Buddhist university. I showed him some of the manuscript of teachings that I was working on. And he said, oh, good, you come and help with the Vipassana, the Theravada Buddhist meditation. And so from David McClellan's house, which was this kind of nexus of wild, wonderful, creative Dharma people from India, I fell in love again. I was so happy being in the monastery. And I came back to America and I was lonely and kind of by myself. And then I got to David McClellan's house and I met Ram Dass and Danny and Tara and all these people. And it was love at first sight. Mm-hmm. It was really fantastic. I felt like I was home again.
Yeah. And did you and Joseph meet at Naropa?
We met at Naropa. We had met the year before. There was, you were doing a be-in or a Dharma, actually it was a Dharma festival in Boston, at Boston University in 1973. And Joseph Goldstein had come back from India, not for the last time, but almost, and needed a place to stay. So somebody called me, maybe it was Danny, and said, you know, do you have a place for some of these old India Wallas, my friends, to come and crash on the floor? Of course, Joseph came with a bunch of other people from India because they were all acting like they were still in India, crashed on the floor. And that's where I met him. But it wasn't until the first summer in 1974 at Naropa that we all really became heart friends. It was somehow we got there and it was a moment where we said, we're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then people started to say, well, teach us, do a retreat, stuff. And you came to... One of the first retreats I taught was in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, with Joseph and maybe it was Richard Barsky.
Yeah.
You came to that retreat. And a number after we got IMS, Ram Dass, I remember you coming to sit at the center in Barrie, and everyone was doing their Vipassana walking meditation, this very slow, mindful kind of zombie walk that we do in Vipassana. And you would do it between the picture of Jesus in the stained glass window in the upper walking room on one side and some saint on the other. And you said it was the only place in the Buddhist building that had this bhakti love in it, and that was your spot. The Buddhists were a little dry, you said.
But you have, didn't you, in your recent book, I see some bhakti in you.
Yes, yes. I've borrowed it from the Hindus. It's helping. I know I needed it. You know, the sweetness. It's made such a difference, actually. There's a way in which the Buddhist practice that we started with was very austere. And you could say dry. That's what you used to say. But it was very austere. And it had tremendous clarity and a kind of wisdom, but it didn't have so much heart.
Yeah.
And then we would go and sit with you, you know, and the chanting. And I want to ask you a question. We all have questions for you, but I want to ask you a question about Hinduism and Buddhism. You've watched in these decades as this whole dance of people going back and forth between Hindu practice and Buddhist practice in the West. And, you know, what do we have to learn from one another? What do you see in this Hindu-Buddhist dance?
Well, it's interesting. I studied with your teacher in Thailand and Joseph's teacher in
Bodh Gaya, Manindra, Goenka,
Mahasi Sai,
Burma.
Upandita.
And that mindfulness and straight, it made my bhakti trip take off, because when I wanted to focus on my guru, I focused in the same way in breath. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I went 1-2. It's not, I don't think it's dry and wet. It's Buddhism came out of Hinduism, in like Christianity came out of Judaism. Mm. And there are parts of Hinduism that are very much like Buddhism. And for we Westerners, we took the East to our minds and our hearts. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism and Hinduism represented deepening of deepening our understanding of ourselves. And I don't think, and that's They vary in method, but I don't see. We can talk about goal or like I say, the one is to merge with the one. Hmm. And that isn't a Buddhist thing. If you give me the Buddhist thing now.
Merge with the zero, maybe.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting as you were saying that. I think I found bhakti in Buddhism when I started practicing with some of the Tibetan teachers who were devoted to the consciousness to emptiness, that somehow the ultimate reality was worthy of a kind of deep love.
Yeah.
And that
and they of, also great gurus, and they good guru kripa.
Right. Because Tibetan Buddhism was so close to Hinduism. Yeah. So we had got the Southeast Asia Theravada Buddhism, and then there was this other thing that came in and I think opened a lot of hearts.
Gave a lot of heart to us, yeah. And it made it. I mean, now the way we teach Vipassana is filled with metta and compassion and loving kindness and much more devotion and service. And it feels like Hinduism has crept its way in and kind of moisturized and opened the way we understood Buddhism. There's a lot of devotion in Thailand and Burma, but that's not what we went for. We went for that very strict stuff. And now we realize that what we needed was really to bring in the heart.
Well, I had a question related to this on the eve of Valentine's Day. And that is, I've always loved the Gandhi title of his autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth. I've always loved that concept, my experiments with truth. But I notice in my own case, I feel like my experiments are now with love. And I was wondering if you would speak about your experiments with love all these years. And
oh, boy. Well, I'll tell you, it's very, very immediate for me. I'm now working with the concepts which you will this ego, which is who I think I am, and this soul. Okay.
What's that?
Well, I'm giving you awareness. Uh-huh. Awareness is down here, which I think you don't know what you don't aware out here. You here. I have my awareness, uh-huh. And that's because, and the soul is awareness, and I see it as loving awareness.
Okay. Sweet.
That's beautiful.
Now this is such far out stuff, because I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. Now, that means that anything that I aware of, I love.
That's beautiful.
Because Maharaji turned me on and turned a lot of us on. His love, which was like the when I came to him, he first mentioned that I had the night before thought about my mother. And I was in front of him. He was here. And I was, oh my God, I started, he knows all the things that I don't want anybody to know. And I started listing them to my, you know, don't, and I looked out at the grass. Oh my God! Just those, you know, those terrible ones. And then he was standing right there; his head was here. And I looked up, and it was the first time I was confronted with unconditional love. And he looked at me with such love, and I knew he's a mind reader, you know.
Right. He knew.
And he just loved me and loved me and loved. And I thought, well, now, if that unconditional love, how would I unconditional love? My gosh, I love this wall. And this, after all, this wall is a manifestation. You know, it's built by, but it's a manifestation. Mm-hmm. And I love this wall. I just love it. And when I'm down here, when I, the ego has as its base fear. This down here, which we'll call something else, this is based in love. Mm-hmm. And I know because it, in the Hindu business, Atman and the Jivatman. The Jivatman is the individual soul. Mm-hmm. And the Atman is the one. And you have it, you have it, you have it, I have it. Mm-hmm. And they have it. Mm-hmm. And
it's not personal.
No. Mm-hmm. No. And it's wisdom, it's peace. Is compassion, it's joy, it's all those things. Mm. And the Jivatman comes out of that. See, the ego comes, the ego is part of the incarnation. So the ego is frightened of death because it, death means the end of the incarnation. But this going from incarnation to incarnation to incarnation, and it tried this one, and it, I don't know where when it came in, but it's came in. Mm-hmm. And it's already died plenty of times, and but and so, this is couched in love. It's couched in love. And when Maharaji said, Ram Dass, I want you to love everybody. And I said, I can't do that, Maharaji. The spirit of here. Mm-hmm. Because he was trying to get me to be my soul. And so then I got home and I thought, this is earlier, but now I said, somebody that I can't love like George Bush. And so I got a frame and I put George Bush on my puja table. Now, the puja table is full of souls. But then there's George. George, I looked at is an incarnation because I know him as president and so on. So I thought, well, that poor soul that has that incarnation, it's like Ravana in the Ramayana. So I thought of George as that soul that, and perhaps that soul taking a very, very unfortunate incarnation.
Unfortunate for a lot of people.
I know it. Like Ravana.
Yes, exactly.
See, and Ravana it said in the Ramayana, Ravana was in his last
birth,
a very high yogi. It sounds like a trick from thing, you know.
Yeah.
And it meant that he said, you want to love everybody, and mm-hmm. everybody has that mm-hmm. soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So that's
beautiful.
Do you want?
I love that phrase, loving awareness. I love that.
I see the Vipassana as a way to get the ego out of the way so that the heart can open
yes.
to that loving energy.
The heart can witness the mind and its product.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Didn't you have a question?
No, I just had a comment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any particular question at this moment. Do you have a question? Do you have an answer?
I just asked one.
You have answers.
Neither an answer nor a question. It seems for me what you're saying has been a lot of the journey, that there's some way I needed to use mindfulness first just to see the waterfall of thoughts, the amazing, chaotic, neurotic stuff there, and realize that there was some other place from which to be aware of it. So already that was some shift of identity, but it needed the heart to come in, just as you're saying, whatever language, soul, heart, somehow. In some way, I couldn't even let myself drop more deeply without that love. Otherwise, it was judging, okay, how are you doing? Are you doing your meditation, doing all right? Yeah, I have a little scorecard, or, am I being a good yogi? Or, and then all of a sudden, no, it's not about that. It's loving awareness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that actually lets awareness open. I mean, then they become, as you say, they're married. They're just the...
Yeah, just...
I have a different question, because I'm thinking about the moment that Wes described of being in Bodh Gaya with you and Joseph Goldstein and Danny Goleman and all those people at that Goenka retreat.
Mirabai
Bush.
That's right.
And thinking about destiny, because there's some way in that those 30 people have flowered and kind of like Johnny Dharma seed or something. They've just scattered, Dharma across the Western world. Do you have any thoughts about destiny or what makes something like that happen?
There's a thing that it's too bad language is interfering, but there is a thing called soul pods.
Soul
pods. They in Hinduism?
No.
In Howie.
In science fiction, what?
it was some people. You want me to tell you?
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
it's souls who travel together, and familiar. Somewhere I've known
you're in
you.
A pod now, it seems.
Yes, here. Three peas in a pod. Yeah,
that's what it is. Three peas in a pod. So I just think that is in Dharma land, or if we have where we are connected, and then we come and the mess this is,
The mess I think, you know, historically, the West was so hungry for some other way of understanding the world. And, you know, we've sort of progressed ourselves into a corner, and we need to find different ways of being and different ways of living.
But we all took the
acid. Huh? We all took the acid. No,
it was psilocybin first, and then
we all took the pill.
We all took the riches from the East, and we recognized them. I guess acid in not
helped.
Helped. Because I could see my progression from psychology. My psychology didn't quite have insight to the levels of consciousness that I felt I should get, and then acid, it got to them, and I throw and somehow I should be living in all these planes of consciousness. But all I noticed when I went back and forth from Nainital to New York City. New York City was full of ego, and Nainital, they were souls. Mm. They were souls, and they did their roles. They did their roles, the sweeper or something like. They did it as, you know, nothing. Mm. And they never, they don't, you know, around here, what do? Yeah. And that they don't, they I'm a sweeper. I'm the governor. Doesn't matter.
Well, Jack, you talk a lot about, you know, the potential that the positive states, that's what we weren't paying any attention to, that that psychology was mostly dealing with neurosis
and pathology. You have pathology. That DSM-4, and it's full of a thousand different pathological states, and it's all about getting the right medicine or seeing what's wrong with you instead of seeing the way Maharaji saw you with the love.
Well, that's one of the things I question about you. But you had spiritual training, and then I left psychology. Yeah, and you.
I needed it. I had these. You know, maybe you know something about this. I had some uncooked seeds.
Yes. Yes.
And the meditation, parts of it was fantastic, and I had rapture and joy and oneness, and then I would fall back like acid, not quite. And then I realized that that I had also done the kind of spiritual bypass, you know, some kind of end run around some of that stuff. Yeah. And I needed to deal with that stuff somehow and to figure out. There was a kind of, you know, I would drop into maybe ego, you would call it, or someplace where I felt wounded, abandoned, incredibly lonely, and believe that stuff, even though another part would say, I know that's not true. Wait a second, it really felt true. So I need to go back to kindergarten.
I see.
You know?
I see.
Some of us are slow learners.
I see. Because I could say, why does he do that?
I needed it. You know, have you seen the, you've seen the end run thing, haven't you? Where people know how to get high, but they do, yeah, use it to kind of and, not deal with stuff? My life
full of them.
Yeah, and now actually, it's interesting because I did this conference a couple of years ago with Thich Nhat Hanh at UCLA, and there was like 2,000 or 3,000 therapists there, and they were so hungry for spirit. They were so hungry not to look through the DSM and see people as damaged beings and, you know, as neurotic and as their pathology, and you're bipolar and you're, you know,
yeah,
obsessive. And they were so hungry to hear from the soul or the love level that that's not who you really are. I mean, the whole room was lit up by just hearing that because they were stuck too.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. 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 I understand you better.
Yeah, I needed it. Slow, slow lane.
Well, I so appreciate that you've made all those experiments, and I think it's great for a person in a teaching role to model the fact that, you know, you're not claiming any kind of perfection, that there's...
Oh?
Even though it's perfect, there's still room for improvement.
That's
the great Zen Master says.
Yeah.
It's kind of a gift, too.
It is. Well, it's a different... I mean, it's not about the perfection of the personality, as you would say.
Yeah.
It's the perfection of love.
Yeah.
And it, or as the Zen patriarch says... You know, to be enlightened is to be without anxiety about non-perfection, to love it somehow.
Yes.
That's a little heady.
That's, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's really to perfect your, just the question that you asked, you know, yeah, could you love this life, this incarnation and the spirit behind it somehow? Mm-hmm. What is that,
yeah,
incredible luminosity?
Mm.
When I inhabit my soul, there is so much love in my life.
Mm. Mm.
So much love in my life.
I can see that. You're surrounded by
it. People so much love that love.
Love that love.
Love that love. And
you're waving at them in the beach and they're all waving back. Look what happened. We came along with you.
Oh dear.
Oh dear. It's like in the ocean of love. And you've got to start with I am a loving consciousness, a loving awareness. And there are so many people, like people on the web. Somebody calls me. We call them heart to hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And on the and the Skype, and they're in the living room, and I'm in my living room, and I haven't met this person. And I said to him, I love you so much.
Mm.
I love you just so much. And I just love you. You have the most beautiful heart. And the person's just like a flower.
Mm. I'm working at being okay with imperfection, the imperfection of the world, the sorrows of the world, my own aging animal that I am. You know, that incarnation is very strong in me. And, you know, I can love it sometimes, but often it's not easy. I see so much sorrow in the world that makes me sad.
do?
Suffering, we're talking about.
Yeah, the big D.
Dukkha.
How do you interpret suffering?
Getting what you want. What you don't want is suffering. Not getting what you want is suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Yeah. Right. Having needs. Having a constant. I mean, I could go on.
Meaning, this is not what is suffering, but how do you interpret it? What does it mean? Is it have a purpose? Is it a mistake? That's the question.
Yes. For me, the worst suffering is the cruelty that I see to human beings, to animals. Really gets to me.
What is the purpose?
Do you see it as a mistake?
Can't we get enlightened without suffering? Do we have to have it in the mix?
No, but I know.
But if you'd have created a world was different, then there wouldn't be suffering. We would be enlightened and we could. No. All right. We got to have it. Come on. Bring it on.
See, like, I a stroke, you know?
Yeah.
So I was a stroke, and everybody in all the around me in the hospital, and I had Maharaji on the wall, and I said to Maharaji, you gave me so much. So much, and then comes the stroke. What were you at the lunch or what? You know? and then I started to his grace. The grace, and so I kept bringing them together and bringing them together and bringing them together. And then I got this this concept. Grace. I'll get fierce grace.
Mm.
Fierce grace.
Mm.
Well, this is fierce grace.
Yeah.
And have I learned some things from this thing?
What would you say are some of the most important?
Well, for example, before the stroke, I wrote a book with Paul Gorman, How Can I Help? I can help. Yeah. Now, if I write a book, it would be, how can you help me?
Right. So there's a great humbling there.
Great humbling and dependency.
Yes.
Mm. And these were things I was so...
resistant.
Resistant, but that... then I was silent for a while because and it wanted... And the silence was so golden.
Mm-hmm.
So golden.
You didn't have to speak.
I didn't have to speak. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
You had said at one point that that meditation didn't, I mean, when the pain was so intense, that meditation didn't offer you relief that you might have thought it would.
Yes. Pain is the adversary to my sadhana. Mm. And pain is, it captures your
attention.
Consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get pain, I get caught in the pain. And then I'm caught in the pain.
Right.
He's caught in the pain.
It's your pain.
And that pain God was distant from me. Distant from me. And I think of other people's pain. Hmm. That's the one we're dealing with. Other people's pain. But I think the question is, why is there suffering pain? And I have, because I'm a guru and son, I have a surrender. And the one is farther up the mountain than me. My mind, why does that suffering? Oh, Jesus. That's with empathy.
Hi, sweetie.
Hey.
And
she thinks my hair is another cat.
But that empathy is one to one. Compassion is one. There's a fellow that's got AIDS and his family doesn't speak to him and he's broke and he's got all his skin is falling and when I go into his room, I used to go in as a caring person, a caring person. Then I went into his room. I'm a soul and he's a soul. And so I said to him, what's the incarnation like? And he tells me, I tell him how my incarnation.
How's your incarnation?
And he's getting, because I'm mirroring his soul. And his soul doesn't have to suffer. But let's think of the why suffering. See, because suffering gives you a leg up of understanding your attachments. One attachment is life versus death. I've gotten into that sitting with people at their bedsides, and I see that it comes. That everything around them, this pictures of a family, the doctors, the friends, everybody is saying, come on, come on, come on, come on. And there's nobody there to say, you're going through a ceremony, like a ceremony. And maybe you should have, I'm going to be neutral. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be neutral. Mm-hmm. And if you want a neutral rock, I'm here. Mm-hmm. But I've got to work with my fear about death.
Yeah, it's easier to do for somebody else than when it comes, I want you to sit with me.
Yeah.
It's easier to do for somebody else, but when it's your own death, somehow it engages that other part that says, no, wait a second, I have my pictures in my family,
But I wanted to ask a question. I know you've sat with a lot of people who have died, and do you find that for the most part, people do let go just before? Like, do you find, it's been my sense, my cousin I found out today just died a few days ago. I don't know, I didn't hear the details of who was with him or how that passing went, but he had just had a horrible operation and was on life support. He probably wasn't very conscious, but it's been my sense when I've heard of other deaths, most everyone I've heard about, there comes a point where they do just let go. Do you find that?
Yeah. They like my father, he was a bear.
A man.
Man. And he got to the point, then he became...
like a child or...
Yeah, the word I had when he was in his early years, and he and I would sit out at his golf course at and there was one night a beautiful sunset. So I said, Dad, isn't that beautiful? And he said, but you see how beautifully it cut.
The lawn, you mean?
The lawn, because he just cut the lawn. That's who he was.
Yes.
But now he's 94, and he's in bed, and I'm holding his hand. And this beautiful sunset, and he, Rich, isn't that beautiful? Oh, see wow. That? The yes. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us to have this wonderful conversation, waving to us on the beach and getting us to come to your home. And
I didn't know I was such riches in
and easy pickups.
Right.
Offer us some food, we show up.
Right. Namaste.
Bye.
Namaste.
Namaste. Be happy.
Be happy.
Or not, as you like.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ramdas has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.